This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with law student Daniel Gross, who was fired from his job at Starbucks after 3 years of union organizing there.
Think twice before you go and order that cappuccino. There is a national boycott of Starbucks. The National Lawyers Guild is one of the endorsers.
The New York City Police Department has proposed a rule that will dictate how many people can legally ride their bicycles or walk down the sidewalk together without a permit.
If you go on a bicycle and you're with your family, more than two or two or more, you can be stopped by the cops and it can be called a parade. Can you believe it? Me and my son parading down the street on our two bicycles.
Recently this month, the 11th Circuit decided U.S. v. Compa, the case of the so-called Cuban Five.
A real political outrage in the 11th Circuit. Once again, Miami, which tried these people with a prejudiced jury, is found to be not prejudiced.
Our own Michael Ratner will talk about the shifting sands of the Geneva Convention.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we'd like to update listeners regarding the latest issues coming out of Guantanamo. In particular, we want to talk about our fine government's attempt to, for the first time in, I don't know how many years, 100 years, modify, change, amend the Geneva Conventions, essentially. It arises out of a decision that took place in the Supreme Court in June of this year called the Hamden case. In the Hamden case, detainees at Guantanamo challenged the special commissions, military commissions, that were set up by the President of the United States, the administration, to try them for so-called war crimes. The detainees complained to the court that they couldn't be tried by these military commissions, that these commissions lacked fundamental rights. You didn't have a right to see the evidence against you. You didn't have a right to be present at the trial. They could use coerced evidence against you, and you could be actually excluded from the trial. They went up to the Supreme Court and they said, you can't do this to us. This is contrary to the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions require that we have a trial. We, the enemy, so-called enemy combatants, have a trial with all of the judicial guarantees that a civilized society requires. And that's set forth in the Geneva Conventions. The government's position in the Supreme Court is, forget about it. We can try you however we want, and the Geneva Conventions have no application to the people at Guantanamo. And that was what the president said, if people recall, in February of 2002. The president said, while we like the Geneva Conventions and everything, these people are bad people, they're terrorists, and we're not going to apply Geneva Conventions to anybody we think might be in Al-Qaeda. The case goes to the Supreme Court, and in a 5-3 decision, they decide Geneva Conventions apply to Al-Qaeda, that the trials are unfair, and you can't do trials this way. Now, remember, it's 5-3. Justice Roberts, who was the newest Chief Justice, couldn't sit on the case, otherwise it would have been 5-4. He couldn't sit because he'd already decided in the lower court, when he was a lower court judge, that the president was right and Geneva didn't apply. But in any case, this court decided 5-4 that Geneva Conventions apply to Al-Qaeda. Now, it's a really crucial ruling because in the context of that ruling, The court said the president has to obey Geneva. They quoted some founders, James Madison and others, saying that when you have the legislative, executive, and judicial powers all in one person, the president, which is what these commissions essentially were going to do, that's tyranny. So the decision was an earth-shattering decision in many ways, but particularly earth-shattering around the Geneva Convention point. And it went to a much broader point than military commissions. What it went to and what the government is now concerned by and the Congress is concerned by is that once you apply Geneva in these cases, it means you can't do a whole bunch of things to people you have in your custody. You can't have them stand in the cell for 40 hours. You can't have them go through hypothermia by taking the temperature down to 30 degrees, leaving them stand there, throwing cold water on their heads. You can't hood them, possibly. You can't strip them. You can't waterboard them. You can't use dogs. That's what Geneva prohibits. It's called Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. It's the fundamental baseline by which any civilized society is supposed to run any kind of prison or hold anybody in custody. It prohibits cruel treatment, inhuman treatment, torture, across the board. It doesn't just mean in Guantanamo. That means across the world where any U.S. person, where any U.S. official has anyone in custody. Now, the reason that's so important is that it really set off alarm bells, particularly within the CIA and probably the military. What the heck these guys are saying? Here's some low-level guy who's been doing this kind of treatment to some so-called enemy combatant, and he's sitting there and saying, you mean I might be violating Geneva Conventions? Well, not only violating Geneva Conventions, but if you violate Geneva Conventions, and particularly these provisions having to do with how you treat people, you're guilty of what's called a war crime. War crime is pretty serious stuff. War crime is prohibited under the U.S. statutes. War crime statute, it's called. You can be found jailed for 20 years if the person in custody doesn't die. And if the person dies, you can actually be jailed for life or executed. This is a serious, serious business. So now after the Supreme Court decision, you have all these CIA people and others sort of shaking in their boots saying, one, are we going to be prosecuted for this? And so one issue that the president has to worry about now and Congress is worried about is the CIA coming to them and saying, we don't want to ever be prosecuted. And while your administration may not prosecute us, it may be that some future administration may prosecute us or other people up the chain of command for this. So they got to figure out a way to protect them. And then the other reason that the issue is an important one about how you can treat people is this government, this administration, the Cheney, Bush, cabal, want to continue torturing people and treating people contrary to Geneva. How is some guy in some CIA hellhole out there across the universe going to have people in custody and continue to be able to chain them to the floor, strip them, throw cold water on them, deprive them of sleep, and waterboard them? Waterboarding, as you may remember, is ducking their head in water and make the people feel like they're drowning. So they have two problems. They want to protect people going backwards, and they want to protect people going forwards so they continue to torture people. So what do they decide to do? They decide, well, why don't we just essentially amend the Geneva Conventions? The way they're doing it is they're going to amend the war crime statute so that it interprets the Geneva Conventions, and so people can no longer be prosecuted under the war crime statute. And they do that simply by redefining the Geneva Convention terms, cruel treatment, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and the like terms. But the real term is cruel treatment in the Geneva Conventions. And they simply define it so that it only means really torture. It doesn't mean any of these other kinds of things that we've been talking about, even though we might call some of them torture. They're trying to say it only is very narrowly now to be interpreted, so it only includes things like the thumb screw, essentially, or choking people almost to death, or organ failure, or whatever else. And not only does it redefine it, it says the way it has to be redefined is so you have to have the specific intent to actually want to cause that kind of harm to a person. So if your intent is really just to interrogate them, but not to really cause tremendous harm to them, you're out from under. What a friend of ours on one of our listservs that we have on torture calls this new statute, which has only been leaked slowly, they call it the CIA Cruelty Authorization Act of 2006. Let me repeat that. The CIA Cruelty Authorization Act of 2006. In other words, let's amend the conventions. Let's not prohibit this kind of cruel and inhuman treatment. Let's authorize it. Let's put it right up front. Let's terrorize. Let's continue to terrorize the Muslim population. So there we have it. Luckily, we have about 2 weeks breathing time because Congress is out. But let me just say, this is not just the administration. This is a lot of people in Congress who in some way are going to wind up trying to immunize the CIA in particular so it can continue to torture people. So while we make great gains politically, we make great gains in the streets, we make some gains in the courts, what you have here is essentially a retrograde administration and a Congress, Democrats included, many Democrats, that sadly have gone along with this fundamental denial of rights to human beings all over the world. Here at Law and Disorder, over the last couple of years, we've been giving you updates on the case of the Cuban Five. You'll all remember that's the case of the five Cubans who were convicted in Miami of various crimes, including unregistered foreign agents, espionage, one of them even for murder, for trying to stop terrorists from going from the United States to Cuba. We've always considered it to be a bad decision and an outrageous decision. And as probably a lot of you know, they were convicted, given very long sentences. And then on the appeal to the 11th Circuit, the court reversed the convictions on the grounds that there was no way that the Cuban Five could get a fair trial in Miami. Unfortunately, after that victory, the entire 11th Circuit met together and issued a judgment the other day saying that the three judges who made the original decision were wrong, and they decided 10-2 that the trial could be fair and was fair, and that the jury was not going to be so prejudiced that they couldn't give a fair trial. Today we're going to talk to Bruce Nestor, who's of the National Lawyers Guild and was one of the people responsible for putting in an amicus brief or friend of the court brief, arguing that the Cubans didn't get a fair trial in that case. So the decision, however, that was lost in the 11th Circuit recently is not the end of the case. There's still a possibility of going to the Supreme Court. In addition to the venue issue, which was lost, there are still a number of other issues that the Court of Appeals will now have to decide.
Bruce, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Bruce, we've talked about the case of the Cuban Five on Law and Disorder before, but would you briefly take us through the stages, including what they were convicted of and what has happened over the last few years?
The Cuban Five are five men who admitted that they were working for the Cuban government. They were present in the United States because of the long history of terrorism that's been committed against Cuba, and they were sent here to monitor and to be involved in anti-organizations that work against the government of Cuba and to provide information about violent activity directed at Cuba. Originally, the information that they collected was actually provided to the FBI by the government of Cuba. And instead of acting on that information, the FBI used that information to track down and arrest the five defendants that we know as the Cuban Five. They were originally indicted in 1998, and they were indicted on charges that they admit that they failed to register as an agent of a foreign government, that they possessed false identification document, U.S. passports, and then more serious charges that they were engaged in espionage, and also that one of the defendants had engaged in a conspiracy to commit murder because of planes that were shot down that were violating the airspace of Cuba. It was a group known as Brothers to the Rescue, which was an organization led by individuals who had a history of violence directed against Cuba. They then proceeded to trial and were convicted of all charges against them. The jury deliberated a very short period of time, and the jury even convicted one defendant on this murder charge, this murder conspiracy charge, after the government itself had said that because of the jury instruction that was given requiring the government to prove certain things that the government didn't believe it could prove, the government had said a conviction on this charge is impossible if you give this jury instruction, is what they told the court. And the jury convicted on all counts nonetheless. it proceeded to sentencing and appeal. And on appeal, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and a panel of three judges of that circuit court reversed all of the convictions on the basis that it was impossible to get a fair trial in Miami because of the long history of prejudice in the community against the government of Cuba and because of the nature of the charges against the five defendants.
Now, I remember that day, Bruce, when it happened, how amazed we all were. 2-1, I think it was a 2-1 decision, is that right?
That's right. And it really was a groundbreaking decision in its willingness to really in-depth examine all of the facts that went into the community atmosphere, the coercion and threats made against jurors during the trial, and the other types of events, such as the Elian Gonzalez affair and all these other matters that were going on during the trial.
And that was almost a 90-page opinion, wasn't it?
It was a very in-depth opinion, and it was very detailed factually. It examined, for instance, in-depth the voir dire questions, which is when a judge questions jurors about whether they can be fair or not. And many of the jurors responded in ways that really revealed the depth of prejudice in the community because they talked about how they would be afraid to return a verdict of not guilty, how they had preconceived notions about anybody that would be associated with the government of Cuba. The fact that the court was willing to really look at the testimony of the community in the form of their responses to voir dire questions, I think, was unique, because many of these jurors were ultimately kept off the jury because of their responses, and yet the responses they gave, although it disqualified them individually, also really illuminated and showed the type of prejudice that existed in the community at large.
You know, there was another thing I remember, Bruce, and you can probably tell us more than I remember, that there was an earlier case where there was a Cuban defendant being sued, I think some kind of civil rights or termination case, and the U.S. government came into the court and they said, we, the U.S., which were, I guess, suing this guy, said, we can't get a fair trial for ourselves here because he's in the Cuban community and they're never going to find him guilty of something because this is a community we can't get a fair trial in for us, the U.S. government. And then I think in the opinion on the Cuban Five, the original opinion in the circuit, they cited that as saying the government can't have it both ways.
It actually was an individual who filed an employment discrimination claim against the U.S. government. In response to that, the exact same attorney's office, which prosecuted the Cuban Five, filed a motion saying we cannot get a fair trial because of the pervasive prejudice in the community against Cuba, and that this individual was both of Cuban origin and was making allegations that because of his anti-Cuban stance, he had suffered some of the harm and that discrimination was related to that. And those were issues that would have come up in the case.
So now we have this 2-1 decision, and what, a year and a half ago?
A year ago, wasn't it? Almost to the day of the most recent decision.
I believe it was It was either exactly 1 year,
you're right,
a year and a day, perhaps.
Now, that decision, as you said, just went off on this venue motion. There were other issues, which we don't have to talk about right this second, but they didn't decide all the other appeals issues because they said, well, there wasn't a fair jury here, and therefore we're getting rid of the whole case.
That's right. The appeal raised numerous issues related to other aspects of the trial and including sentencing issues. None of those have ever been decided by an appellate court. The 2-1 panel decision then was just reversed this month by the entire 11th Circuit.
And Bruce, is that usual for it to then go back to the 11th Circuit? Is that what usually happens?
Certainly, either party, if you're not satisfied with a panel decision, has the right to ask for a rehearing. And then the entire court can grant that rehearing by a vote of the entire court. So I wouldn't say it's unusual, but it is not that you're entitled by any means to review by an entire circuit court. You have to make a showing that the decision of the panel is contrary to law or that there's really some mistake in it requiring further review.
Yeah, I remember people were not too happy when they agreed to hear the case because here you have a 2-1 decision, and people who want to rehear the case are obviously people, if a majority has to say it, people who want to reverse it seemed to me.
And you can really see that, I think, in the decision of the entire 11th Circuit, because the majority opinion, which got 10 votes to basically reinstate the convictions, really fails to engage and do the factual analysis that was done by the panel and then which was also done in the dissent from the decision of the entire 11th Circuit. And that panel decision as well as the dissent really go through all the facts, the voir dire questions, the other events that were happening in the community, the history of violence directed not only against the government of Cuba, but the history of violence within the Miami community directed against anybody that is perceived as supporting the government of Cuba or perceived as less than 100% opposed to the government of Cuba. And I think the majority opinion just considered each issue in isolation. For instance, was there so much news coverage that it was prejudicial? Was the videotaping and photography of the jury during trial so threatening that that was prejudicial? But it didn't put everything together and look at the whole picture in a detailed way that the panel decision and the dissent did. And I think that's what's disappointing about both the decision to grant en banc review, but to then not engage in the same searching review that was actually performed by the panel and by the dissent.
What's the next step in the case, Bruce?
Well, at this point, the attorneys are discussing whether to seek review at this time of the decision of the 11th Circuit and to basically file what's called a petition for writ of certiorari, which is a request that the Supreme Court review the change of venue decision. And that would be have to get a majority of votes from the United States Supreme Court in order to grant review. The other alternative is to return to the panel and to await direction from the panel on how to proceed on the other, I believe, 9 issues that are remaining to be decided. And at this point, I don't know if that decision has been made.
Now, meanwhile, of course, where are the Cuban Five?
They are locked up in high security conditions, in isolation. Most of them are not allowed to have contact with their family because the U.S. government refuses to grant visas to their family members to travel here. Despite the lack of any of these individuals engaging in violence or having any disciplinary history in prison, they're really under very harsh conditions of incarceration in the Bureau of Prison System.
And they're all around the country. They're not in one facility, right?
That's right. They're scattered in facilities around the country, which also puts a burden on their lawyers as well as their family members to try to maintain contact with.
Now, I can imagine that the Cubans are devastated with this decision, because the Five really are icons in that country.
I mean, the Five are seen as defenders of the Cuban people and as protectors of the Cuban people. In the same way that if, I can only imagine, if we had had individuals, United States citizens, who had infiltrated Al-Qaeda and were somehow trying to prevent future attacks upon the United States citizens or United States soil, and if they were, say, arrested by a government and prosecuted and given lengthy sentences in a city or a place where there was pervasive prejudice against Americans, that we would be outraged. And the press coverage that we would be getting in this country would be constant. You know, Cuba views these individuals that same way. Mm-hmm. Because out the trial, there was not even the allegation that they ever obtained any confidential information or any national security information about the United States.
Right. There was not much evidence, actually, against them.
That's right. There was evidence that they were unregistered agents of a foreign government. They admitted that. There was evidence that they had false passports. But the reality that had to be looked at is, why were they here? And it's because the FBI and the U.S. government would not act to prevent attacks against Cuba that were planned and orchestrated from U.S. soil.
And that we know have been going on since the revolution, really.
That's right.
Bruce, we knew a decision would be coming down soon. Is it at all odd to you that with the media reports of Fidel Castro's health that this decision came down soon after that?
I can't believe that the 11th Circuit was able to time it that precisely. You know, they must have been writing that opinion, but maybe I'm not enough of a conspiracy theorist, because I certainly believe that the U.S. government has had longstanding plans in place to try to create instability around any illness or perceived, you know, threat to the ability of Fidel Castro to maintain in power.
Let me ask about that. I saw that, maybe you recall, that Fidel was told about the decision, or there was some reaction. I don't remember. You recall?
I haven't personally seen that yet, whether he's had a particular reaction to it yet. I'm certainly aware the Cuban government has spoken through other persons.
What is their position so far on what's happened?
That this is really just an outrage, that the panel decision really was an opportunity for justice and for a fair trial, and that at this point, to continue the punitive incarceration of the five, as well as to reverse what was really a well-reasoned decision. Part of what has to be remembered here is that the defendants in this case were only asking for the case to be transferred to Fort Lauderdale, which, you know, is really just several hours away. Right. And it wouldn't have put a great burden on the U.S. government to prosecute the case there. Tremendous resources were spent on this case. It could have been done in Fort Lauderdale, and yet there was a reason the U.S. government wanted this case prosecuted in Miami. And that was because they knew that's where they would get the most favorable jury pool. And it's the same thing that the U.S. government does in some of their cases against so-called terrorism defendants, where they seek indictments in the Southern District of New York or in Eastern District of Virginia, because they know that both the judiciary and or the jury pool will be conservative or favorable to the government on those types of cases. And I think that's part of the danger of this opinion as a lawyer, is that the majority opinion of the 11th Circuit really is deferential to the decisions of the trial judge, whereas the dissent engages in what lawyers call a de novo review, meaning looking at the evidence again, looking at it in a searching and detailed way. If you accept that the trial judge gets to basically make the final decision on venue, it really gives tremendous power to the government to choose where to bring a prosecution and to bring it in a place where it's unfair to the defendants without effective judicial review of that decision. In a broader sense, that's a concern I have of this opinion, in addition to the particular concerns of what it means for these five individuals.
So now I guess it's just going to be a period of time again. I mean, how long? It could be a year, 2 years, or more before we actually get to a result.
My belief is that the briefs in this case were something like 160 pages long, or even longer. The remaining issues to be decided are very complex ones. And one of the judges on the panel, the current panel, is now retired. And so it may be that the entire remaining arguments need to be rebriefed and oral argument done again. It really drags out the appeal process. This reversal.
The major judge was a good judge. It's Judge Oakes, who came out of, I think that's who you're referring to, is from the Southern District and was in the majority of the two and has always been a liberal judge here.
Right. And you'd be more familiar with that than I am.
Yeah, no, Judge Oakes has been a good judge since I've been a practicing lawyer.
Now, Bruce, remind us, Len Weinglass is one of the key attorneys on this case.
That's right. He wasn't involved in trial, but he's been involved from the very beginning of the appellate stages, along with the federal public defender out of Miami, and as well as the other attorneys who represented the other Cuban Five members at trial. Len's a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild, certainly has experience with political trials and understands what it means to take on the U.S. government in a trial that's not only about innocent or guilt, but it also has all these political overtones in the history of relations between the U.S. and the government of Cuba. The National Lawyers Guild is working with Len to continue to publicize what's happening in this case. He's speaking at a number of law schools this fall. We're also working to support the September 23rd rally in March in Washington, D.C., which will try to highlight this case and, again, continue to demand justice for the five.
Is there a website people can go to for information on the Cuban Five or the demonstration?
There is, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's it would be under
Free the Five. I think it's freethefive.org.
That's right.
We'll link that on our website as well so listeners can go to that. It's a crucial case, very important, and it's a horrendous case in many respects, as has been described.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today with this thorough update.
My pleasure, and I just urge people to continue to watch what's happening in this case and to do anything they can to bring attention to what's happened to these five, what I believe, very patriotic individuals.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Bye-bye.
That was Bruce Nestor from Minneapolis, former president of the National Lawyers Guild.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Come ye ranks of labor, come Union Corps, and see if you remember the struggles of before. When you were standing helpless on the outside of the door, and you started building links on the chain, and you started building links on the chain. When the police on the horses were waiting on demand, riding through the strike with a pistol in their hand, swinging at the skulls of many a Union man, as you build one more link on the chain, as you build one more link on the chain. Then the army of the
2 weeks ago, law student Daniel Gross was fired from his job at a New York Starbucks after nearly 3 years of union organizing there. Daniel was terminated when he supported a co-worker and fellow union member on a picket line, asserting to managers that he shouldn't be fired. Daniel is the fourth Industrial Workers of the World member to be fired by Starbucks in less than 1 year. Starbucks and other large corporations such as Walmart and Borders have been known to be hostile to efforts to unionize, despite the fact that Starbucks especially holds itself out to be worker-friendly. This is also a turning point for some card-carrying IWW baristas at Starbucks who promised to keep the union organizing alive. We're delighted to have Daniel Gross with us in the studio today. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
We'd like to start by having you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in Starbucks and just a little bit about yourself generally.
Well, I was working at the 36 and Madison location, and it quickly became apparent to myself and my coworkers that there were serious problems on the job. Despite its socially responsible image, Starbucks is actually a poverty wage employer. Depending on where you are in the country, you can be making as low as $6, $7, or $8 an hour. But there's another piece to the financial picture, and that's the part-time status. 100% of baristas in the United States today are part-time at Starbucks.
What does part-time mean? What's a barista?
The barista is the entry-level position at Starbucks. We do the real work of operating the cash registers, making the drinks, and cleaning the stores.
And you've been a barista for the last 3 years.
Yeah, in Starbucks speak, barista is actually the name of a position, whereas I think barista in Italian did refer solely to the person operating the espresso machine.
So the person that takes the money from you at the cash register has essentially the same status as the person behind the machine?
It's the same person. Basically, the task of the barista is threefold: operating the cash register, and then you'll switch and you'll be shifted to the espresso bar, and then you'll be moved to clean the store.
Are there health benefits or anything associated with the pay?
It's a great question, because Starbucks has anointed itself as the leader in employee health care, quite remarkably. After a lot of pressure from the IWW Starbucks Workers Union.
The IWW is the union. It stands for what?
The Industrial Workers of the World.
We'll go to that history in a second, but tell us more about this health business.
The Starbucks and its chairman, Howard Schultz, you know, every time he puts pen to paper or gives a speech, he tells this great story about healthcare. We on the ground knew that many of us, A, couldn't qualify, and even if you do qualify, it's difficult to afford. So finally, after a lot of pressure, we said, Starbucks, you've called yourself a leader in employee healthcare. Even Walmart releases the percentage of employees actually covered by healthcare. They finally gave up the number. 42% only of Starbucks employees, including management, and it's easier for them to afford, are covered by the healthcare plan.
And is that because you have to be full-time or you have to contribute a certain percentage?
There's a twofold hurdle. One is you have to work 240 hours per quarter. Now, going back to the part-time status, what the part-time status entails is no guaranteed hours per week. A barista could literally get 30 hours of work 1 week, 20 hours the next week, and 15 hours the very next.
They tell you how many hours you're going to work every week.
Exactly.
And everybody's part-time.
everybody's part-time.
So they don't guarantee anybody 40 hours a week.
That's right, unless you're a manager or an executive.
So if you're trying to organize a union, it seems obvious to me what the next point is. If you want to work regular hours and they think you might be trying to organize a union or do anything for employees' rights, you're not going to be working 40 hours a week.
That's one of the things we've actually been able to achieve so far, organizing, getting together and putting pressure on the company on the job and on the streets, is we have been able to establish more consistent scheduling, which we're very happy about. So it turns out the 42% percentage, not only is it worse than the industry average, it's worse than Walmart, a company rightfully and notoriously condemned for its poor healthcare policy.
It's a great imagine point. It might be less than a third of the actual workers.
It's a great point. The number isn't even the right number, and it's still quite appalling.
And you have to pay that out of your own salary?
Yes, you do. So you have to qualify the 240 hours per quarter, which you may not get. Only 65% of workers qualify to have the ability to even purchase. And once again, the 65% includes managers. Out of that 65%, say you qualify to purchase, then there's the co-pays, the deductibles, and the premiums.
Daniel, did you begin working at Starbucks with the purpose of organizing?
You know, I started working at Starbucks because I needed a job. I was a Wobbly at the time, and
a Wobbly is another name for?
For an Industrial Workers of the World member.
Right.
And a good Wobbly is always on the lookout for organizing opportunities, because we actually believe every worker, except for police and prison guards, should be members of unions. I started working there because I needed to pay my rent, but certainly as a Wobbly, I was, you know, definitely open to
and
organizing opportunities.
Listeners should know you're a law student, aren't you?
I am.
What are the Wobblies? You know, I remember some of this from my labor history, but why don't you tell us a little more?
Yes, well, actually, last year we celebrated our 100th anniversary. We were founded in 1905 in Chicago to organize all workers, regardless of race, of skill, of gender, and the concept was one big union. So as opposed to some of the more conservative unions of the day, we organized with the intent of radically transforming society. We envisioned and continue to envision a world without bosses and without
worker the state, essentially, right?
There's no politics in our union. We actually have a diverse array of different political groups and orientations and dispositions. There's different takes on exactly how that society would be run.
How'd they get the name Wobbly?
You know, it's a question that's asked a lot, and there's a lot of competing theories. I myself haven't been persuaded by any one of them conclusively, but if you talk to the Wobblies, certainly it's a term of affection, and, you know, it's someone you can depend on to be strong on the shop floor, and someone believes that, you know, we can make change through direct action. We don't need to, you know, work through the government or, you know, mediate our efforts through union bureaucrats.
You've really been at this for 3 years. You've had successes. And tell our listeners what's happened in the last few months.
Well, you know, Starbucks finally did the dirty deed and fired me. It's a very crude tactic that companies use to intimidate and chill organizing efforts. I'm one of four baristas that have been fired for union activity in less than a year.
From the same Starbucks or different ones?
From different locations.
In New York or
different? In New York City, yeah. What's remarkable and even more disturbing, in March, our union won a very significant labor board case against Starbucks, where the company agreed to refrain from interrogations, threats, bribes, coercion. The settlement reinstated two of our previously discharged members who had been taken out for union activity. It was a very big settlement, and there was a hope out there the company would pull back at least on its worst excesses of union busting. But sadly, they're going for the jugular now, and they continue to trample on the right to organize with impunity.
Now, in this case, Starbucks is saying that you were aggressive on the picket line with respect to a coworker.
It was actually a district manager, and it's an offensive allegation that they've made. Interestingly, in the course of the investigation, they declined to speak to two current Starbucks employees that were actually eyewitnesses to the event. One of our members in the union who was working at 14th Street and 6th Avenue had been suspended on a very thin pretext. And so we called for a leafleting action in support of Evan. It was a very, frankly, routine type of leafleting action. We were talking to customers as they come in and
outside of the store.
Outside of the store, encouraging them to support Evan. And when the district manager of Evan's district came in, who was one of the decision makers who would decide whether after the suspension he'd be fired or not, she came in and I quite simply asserted my solidarity with Evan verbally, absolutely. I said, don't fire Evan. You know, I think it would be, you know, I expressed my belief that it would be a mistaken decision to fire Evan because he decided to go union. Didn't think about it for 1 second after the event until I was sat down for an interrogation in the back of my store by a Starbucks investigator.
What qualifies that person as an investigator?
I asked him his title and he said, my title is investigator for partner and asset protection. He attempted to have me sign a very interesting legal document on the legal side that the document said, you agree to allow us to question you for as long as necessary. You're not being threatened or promised anything. And you can leave at any time, but if you fail to cooperate, you'll be fired. So I found that interesting that one could sign away the ability to be interrogated for
I presume I presume you didn't sign.
I didn't sign.
I have a question because I'm not sure I understand this. Is that you're in the Wobblies in the IWW, but that particular branch of Starbucks, has that actually been unionized?
What we have is a model where we have dues-paying members at 6 New York City Starbucks. We're eschewing the NLRB certification system.
That's what I'm really asking about. So that there's no requirement that, at least through the NLRB, that they do collective bargaining with you.
Right, right. We prefer to avoid that process because it's just so flawed. And early on in the campaign, the Bush administration's National Labor Relations Board weighed in on the side of the company, which really makes the vote a potential vote a sham. Some of the stores where we have members, we take members public when they're ready to march into their store and announce their union membership. They made demands regarding insect and rodent infestation at the stores. Obviously, every worker deserves to work in a safe and healthy environment.
And coffee consumers need to have coffee that's prepared in sanitary conditions.
Health and safety is something we don't compromise on. I mean, you only have one body in this world, and management's response was really woefully inadequate. They have periodic and, frankly, ineffective extermination visits, but they've never gone after repeated requests to the root of the problem, which is the sanitation in the stores, proper food storage.
Now, I remember once I found a bug in my in a drink at Starbucks. I went up to the manager, and I said, what's that bug doing in my drink? And he said, it's doing the backstroke.
So,
that was a joke, Daniel, just to be clear.
You know, it's funny because at the press conference today, one of our members actually reported that a water bug did fall on the shoulder of a customer. So I laugh, but, you know, it is a serious matter. But there have been some interesting images that we've seen. We've seen a rat on a Starbucks napkin. So, you know, to keep a good sense of humor about it. But, yeah, it's certainly very troubling.
Did you call the health inspector?
No, we filed the OSHA complaint, but what the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene do is they do periodic inspections. And we did, using their data, what we're calling the Creepy Crawly Starbucks 44, which are the 44 Starbucks locations in New York City that in the Department of Health's last inspection were issued notice of violations for either insect or rat or both presence. So it's very troubling.
44 stores?
44.
How many stores are there in New York?
There's a bit over 200.
Including the boroughs, right?
Including the boroughs.
So that's almost a quarter of all their stores.
Where can you get that report?
StarbucksUnion.org.
Now, you can also get the health reports. There's a website that the city now runs. I don't remember how to get
it. Exactly. You can Google NYC Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, and you can type in Starbucks, and you can see the wide array of violations.
The National Lawyers Guild has called for a boycott of Starbucks stores, so we hope that listeners will not buy their coffee from Starbucks until this is resolved.
Now, if there's other people around the country who work at Starbucks. There may be other places, I don't know if there are, where there's organizing, but if there's people out there who want to do some work, is there something they should do?
Absolutely. There are Wobblies waiting with open arms for Starbucks workers, other retail workers, or any workers that are interested in coming together and doing better at work, and also joining a global justice movement. You know, it's a great way for workers to interact with the movement for social change, whether it's for peace or for ecological justice. It's a great thing to oppose oppression right there at work and also plug into the global justice movement. The IWW Starbucks Workers Union did call on people not to purchase Starbucks products until all the fired baristas are reinstated, and we were so pleased and honored to have the National Lawyers Guild endorse the call and get the word out publicly. The Guild has been with this campaign actually from day one, essentially in many different areas. There's been remarkable solidarity around the world. Workers in Germany and Austria and the United Kingdom, all over the United States, are handing out leaflets to community members, to workers, to get the word out about the boycott. And we've had endorsements from all kinds of unions. We've had strong support for the fired baristas from the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, which is a large 55,000-member union. We just got our first endorsement from a UAW local in the Metro Detroit area. So it's been really wonderful. People stepping up and saying, look, this is not just about the jobs of four people whose jobs were lost wrongly. This is about whether we're going to be able to organize the Walmarts, the Starbucks, the McDonald's, these multinational giants that don't want a single union member working for them. And they're willing to go to great lengths to crush any union drive to keep workers unorganized and keep workers living a very difficult life at work.
Daniel, we look forward to hearing of some more successes down the road and to having you back on to let us know what happens.
This is really great work. I mean, I'm really proud of you and the people doing this. This is remarkable. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Even though you've
been
fired, Daniel.
the fight's just beginning. It's been wonderful to be here, and there's so much coming up, you know, escalated outreach for baristas, and we're really excited this fall to be launching the Justice from Bean to Cup campaign on campuses nationwide, which will call for Starbucks both to make a meaningful commitment to fair trade coffee.
I was going to ask you about that. It's another subject, but I'm sure you have a lot to say about the kind of fair trade coffee they're not buying. But
the company buys less than 4% fair trade certified, so campus activists will be calling on the company both to respect their coffee farmers and to respect the right to organize the baristas, with the aim of uniting workers across the Starbucks supply chain, across borders. Starbucks may lose the right to operate on some college campuses if they don't do the right thing, make a meaningful commitment to fair trade, reinstate the baristas, and respect the right to free association in the workplace.
And where do you go for information both, again, about the union struggle as well as about the
Justice from Bean to Cup, the home of the IWW Starbucks Workers Union on the web, starbucksunion.org.
And is there, the Bean to Cup will be on there as well?
Yes.
Okay, that's great.
Well, thanks,
Daniel. This was great. Thank you, and good luck with your various lawsuits and cases against you.
Thank you.
We'll meet you downstairs for a cup of coffee and That was Daniel Gross, union organizer and former Starbucks employee.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Recently, the New York City Police Department proposed parade permit regulations that would dramatically affect both pedestrians and bicyclists in the city. 20 or more pedestrians or bicyclists using the streets or the sidewalks would actually need to apply for a permit. Public outcry to the proposed regulations was immediate, well-organized, and highly critical of the rules and the fact that the police department, and not the city council, was promulgating such regulations. Law and Disorder interviewed Guild member Mark Taylor, who organized a public forum last week on these regulations. In a startling turn of events, the NYPD announced last Friday, just a day after the forum, that it was withdrawing the regulations. We caught up with attorney Gideon Oliver, also a member of the National Lawyers Guild, in the East Village, where outcry to these rules was especially strong. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Gideon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gideon, is this a victory for the activists and individuals who are concerned about these regulations?
It's certainly a victory. It's just a temporary one. It's a victory in a battle. The police department has indicated that they expect to propose other changes to the rules that are somewhat less draconian than the ones they had proposed within a couple of weeks. So the way that I'm viewing this, and I think that I would encourage anyone who's concerned about these issues to view this as a little extension, a little extra time to get our ducks in a row in terms of organizing public outcry to the proposed changes to the rules.
Tell us why you think the NYPD backed down.
Well, I think that the police department decided to rescind the proposed rules because they received so much negative public comment, not just from politicians, although I think that certainly happened in this case and made a big difference, but also from people who just sent in letters and postcards and said, we're going to show up at the hearing and say that and why we think this is a bad idea.
Now, will there be another hearing before the next set of proposals?
There will be another hearing before the next set of proposals. I would certainly encourage anyone who's concerned about these issues to show up and to speak their concerns. The police department is proposing to amend its own internal rules that are designed to implement a provision of the administrative code covering parades, processions, and races that the city council passed. It is really a power grab on behalf of the police department to propose these rules without first going to the city council and saying, is this what we should be doing? Is this what your intent was in passing this legislation in the first place? I think it's going to be very important for people to continue to speak out against the proposed rules.
Gideon, how can listeners find out when the next hearing will be? And is there a website where they can go to if they need a little assistance in joining their voices to this movement?
I would direct people to the Transportation Alternatives website, transalt.org. I would also direct people to the National Lawyers Guild New York City chapter website, nlgmyc.org.
Gideon, you've really been at the forefront of the legal and political movement to hold the New York Police Department accountable for their unconstitutional treatment of protesters, harking back to the Republican National Convention. Thank you on behalf of Law and Disorder for really holding the government accountable.
It's a pleasure and a duty.
We go now to our studio interview with activist Mark Taylor, a member of the National Lawyers Guild. Mark was one of the organizers of a People's Forum last Thursday at St. Mark's Church in the East Village. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark, before we talk about the specific proposed regulations of the NYPD, could you give us a bit of history about how you became involved in these issues?
Sure. I'm a law student at Brooklyn Law School, and I became involved in these issues during the Republican National Convention when there were a lot of protests going on and a lot of people applying for permits so they could have various protests, including Arab Americans asking to use the Great Lawn in Central Park and a lot of other marches that went on.
The NYPD has proposed several new rules that could go into effect as soon as a week or so. What are those proposed rules?
The rules are interpreting the definition of parade within the parade permitting. So the parade permitting law says you need a permit if you're going to parade. But it's pretty unclear about what a parade is.
One of the proposed rules is that any group of two or more cyclists or pedestrians traveling down a public street can be arrested for parading without a permit.
That is right. It's a little bit of a complex definition, but the parade permit requirement kicks in at a group larger than two when anyone disobeys any traffic law. And since it's against the law in New York to block traffic, almost any group of two can be argued to be blocking traffic on the sidewalk or on the street.
Any group greater than two?
Greater than two.
So if I go with two or more. Two or, so yes. If I go with my son and we're like going to the crosswalk a little bit, then we could technically be considered a parade and arrested at that point.
Absolutely.
Arrested for what?
You'd be arrested for parading without a permit. You could also be charged for whatever, jaywalking or...
The problem is it leaves discretion to the authorities, and that's really the crux of the matter.
While a court can take some measure here, having people in the streets is really what counts.
Especially
in the end.
On this issue.
And continuing critical
Mass,
not critical resistance. Critical resistance is good also.
Right.
But critical mass is better.
Mark, thank you so much for joining
this
us
was great.
And keep up the great work.
All right. It's been my thank pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is great.
Bye. Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
We're moving on up now. We're moving on up. We're living proof and all's alert that we're two from the good black church. And we're a winner. And everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing like your leaders tell you to. At last that blessed day has come, and I don't care where you come from. We're all moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. Moving on up. We're a winner, and everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing like your leaders tell you to. At last that blessed day has come, and I don't care when you come from. We're just gonna move on, moving on. Lord have mercy, we're moving on. We're moving on. You know, you may remember reading in your Jet Johnson publications, a whole lot of stations didn't want to play that particular record, We're a Winner. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, I would say the way I'm sure most of you would say, we don't give a damn, we're a winner anyway. Right on? Yeah, I got a little strength out there tonight. Putting fire under us. Out of sight. It's all right now. We have just another version that we'd like to lay to you about here, believing very strongly in the equality and freedom for all, and especially we people who are darker than blue. We'd like to just lay another version to you, trying not to offend anyone, but basically telling it like it is. We're a winner. And never let anybody say, boy, you can't make it, cause a feeble mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, the black boy done dried his eyes. And we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. Moving on up. There'll be no more Uncle Tom, at last that blessed day has come. And we're a winner. And everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing like Martin Luther told you to. And I don't mind leaving here to show the world we have no fear. Cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up. We're moving on up. So people get ready, I've got good news for you. How we got over like we're all supposed to do. Let us all say amen, and together we'll clap our hands. Cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. Moving on up. Continue to be a winner, all of you.